Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page, and I'm joined today by Dr. Bob Gwyther, who is filling in for Adam. Thanks for being with us today, Bob.
Glad to be here.
On our show today, we are going to talk with family physician Dr. Cottie Hendry about demystifying the Canadian health system. And this is going to be a great conversation. She practiced in the United States for many years, but now she's a practicing family physician in Canada. So we're looking forward to that conversation.
But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters.
Yep.
And we have four topics here. Lung cancer being related to the risk of stroke.
And we'll talk about teen driving restrictions, a little bit about kids and asthma.
And encouraging that exercise may also help teens quit smoking.
But first, let's jump into lung cancer linked to risk of stroke. So I'll be interested to what you think about this, Bob, but I was sort of like, yeah, this sounds like something we already knew. But it's published in the journal Stroke, looking at data for 150,000 adults who have lung cancer to see about their risk of having a stroke.
And I was similar to you. I said, what's news about that? Because, you know, people who have lung cancer have the same risk factors as people who smoke and get strokes and all that. So they seem to be quite similar in that way. But then when you add in the fact that some people with lung cancer can have the cancer spread to their brain, that's a setup for smoke.
For stroke.
Everybody who has cancer, at least lung cancer, is more likely to form clots in various places, especially in their heart, which can lead to stroke. And there's side effects from chemotherapy. So this wasn't a great surprise to me.
No, I think it highlights another really important piece of information about smoking, that is not just about the concern for lung cancer, but also your risk, increased risk of stroke if you're a smoker. So take a message there, is now is a good time to quit. The other thing is, if you get diagnosed with lung cancer, that it would be important to have a conversation with your doctor about trying to, okay, I've got this now, how can I reduce the chance that I have a stroke?
Right.
Let's do our next research that matters about teen driving restrictions. Do they save lives, Bob?
Well, the question here is, will they? And, you know, I think most of us believe that if you don't just take a kid, give him a driver's license and say you can go drive any way you want, you're probably going to save some lives. And there are some research trials that have shown that.
So this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association about following death rates in states that have had stricter driver licensing programs, where you have more restrictions on children less than 18 years, about what hours they can drive, how many people they can have in the car, et cetera, see if there's a difference in fatal car crashes.
And overall, with no driving restrictions, about 47 of every 100,000 teens died in a car crash every year on average. And with restrictions, that fell from 47 to 30, which is a fairly substantial reduction.
Yeah, I mean, car crashes, we're talking about more than a third of deaths in U.S. teens. So this is a big risk for teenagers to die in a car crash. And so, you know, the fact that there's a reduction of that, particularly in these studies in the 16-year-olds, to me is encouraging that there may be some benefits, although it's not all 100% borne out.
And most of these restrictions that various states are implementing are how many people you can have in the car at one time, and do you drive after a certain hour at night?
Midnight or something. And we have some of those laws in place for our own teenagers in this area. And it sounds like there's promise. So I think the take-home message is talk to your teenagers and prepare them and try to graduate them into the heavy responsibility of driving.
And the notion that as you get more experience driving, you're probably a safer driver.
The next study we have is about kids drinking raw milk. which just to me sounds gross. But that's because I've been raised in this country and have been, you know, drinking milk bought by the store for most of my life. And this is actually sounds a little promising that maybe kids who drink raw milk have less asthma and allergies. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I think back to the a similar sort of thing that was proven that farmers' children, where they're living out in the country, lots of crops around, lots of trees around, kids are outside, have less asthma than people who kids that are raised in our little air-conditioned, dust-free houses, too. So that I think there is something to the body becoming accustomed to the presence of certain allergens and tolerating them better if they as children are exposed to them, whereas later on, if that's the first exposure, they could develop an immune response, and asthma could be said to be one of those.
Yeah, it's interesting that compared with the kids who only drank store-bought milk, those who drank raw milk had a 41% reduction in their odds of developing asthma. But again, is that, I wanted to look at this in more detail, is that related to where they lived? Because we know that people living in cities or where they're closer proximity to other people or to roaches or to whatever living conditions are more likely to have asthma and allergies. And so it's an association, but I wouldn't go out and buy a bunch of raw milk. And in fact, CDC says, you know, that there can be harmful bacteria and other germs that can cause really severe illness. So they're not recommending raw milk for everyone.
Right. You know, historically, tuberculosis was transmitted by cows in milk in the way, way old days, and we're not talking about that. But I agree. I think we're still looking at an element of safety by pasteurizing milk, keeping it refrigerated, and not drinking raw milk for most of us.
I would agree. And the last one is about exercise and teenagers quitting smoking. This was in the Journal of Pediatrics to look at the effects of adding advice to exercise to a teen-focused smoking cessation program. And this was these are teenagers taken in schools. They randomly assigned 19 different high schools to either offer standard quitting smoking programs compared with that program plus advice to exercise and to get a pedometer to try to help track how much they exercise.
And it turns out that particularly boys had a 37% chance, a better chance of quitting compared to 18 or 20%. And the girls did not seem to change that very much. Reason for that difference is unclear to me.
No, but it's promising to me that, you know, teenagers, it's concerning if you continue to smoke. I mean, we need to focus our efforts on having children not start smoking. But these are vulnerable times, and if we can make a difference, and even if we only make a difference in the boys, if we can make a difference in helping them quit now, I mean, just think about what a healthier life they'll have in the future. So I found it promising, although sad that it seemed to only help the boys.
But you know what? Exercise is good for anybody. So I think it's a good idea to do it, whether you're dealing with a boy or a girl.
Yeah, I think the take-home point here is if you have a teenager who is smoking or you know a teenager who's smoking, you know, or anybody for that matter, it's a good idea to talk about ways to quit. And one of them might be to curb that urge to smoke by going out for a run or getting some exercise.
And I think that also just puts health in their mind at the same time.
That's true. All right. Well, we've had a chance to talk about a little bit about helping teens quit smoking through exercise, about a little bit about raw milk potentially having a link with less asthma and allergies, about teen driving restrictions saving lives, and about lung cancer being linked to risk of stroke.
We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Katya Hendry about demystifying the Canadian healthcare system.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. I'm joined today by my guest host, Dr. Bob Gwyther, who is filling in for Adam. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Cottie Hendry about demystifying the Canadian health system. Dr. Hendry is a U.S.-trained family physician like me and Bob, but she has worked in British Columbia in a private family practice since 2004. So she has experienced both sides of the healthcare system in the United States and in Canada.
So I'd like to start just by figuring out exactly what you've done in the United States and what you've done in Canada so people understand what your references are.
Well, sure. It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. I actually spent more time in the States than in Canada. I am an American, a U.S. citizen, and I did my training in the U.S. And then I got my dream job working in a community health center in Oakland, California, way back when, in 1980. And I worked there for almost 25 years.
Wow. That's real service.
It was quite a bit, actually. So while I was there, the clinic grew, and I had more responsibilities. So I was the medical director of that, and then was the medical director of a whole network of community health centers in that area. So I got quite heavily involved in administration. And then after I had some other opportunities that came up and some personal things, getting married and so on, I had a chance to move to Canada. So I've been working here for the last 7 years as a family doctor.
Fantastic. So you said how many years now that it's been that you've been working in Canada?
Well, getting a little long in the tooth, obviously, but it was about 25 years in Oakland,
uh-huh.
U.S.
And how many years in Canada?
And it's been almost exactly
seven years. So you really have had an experience that is more than just a glance at each of the healthcare systems.
Yes, I feel like I've had quite an intimate look at a number of the issues that people are concerned about on both sides.
So I'd say in this country, people who are physicians are pulling their hair out because they're not satisfied with the system. Lots of patients don't have access to the system and are not happy about that. It's about to bankrupt the country, and everybody in Washington is screaming and yelling. So the Canadians, by repute in this country, have a pretty good system. People have access to the system, and they seem to be more content. Is that your experience?
That is exactly my experience. Actually, I have to say that when I moved up here and started working, it felt a little bit like I'd finally stopped banging my head against a wall.
Mm.
It felt really good to stop.
Mm.
So, it's quite a relief to be working in a system where you're not spending most of your energy essentially fighting to make things better for your patients, fighting the insurance companies, fighting the rules and regulations, things changing underneath you all the time, worrying about patients that can't get what they need. It's been an amazing journey, and one I'm really happy to have been able to make.
So as it relates to primary care and being a family physician or being a patient receiving primary care, how would you summarize the major differences between the two systems?
Well, as far as the medical care goes, it's really hardly different at all. In other words, if I see someone in my office, they're going to have the same cold, they're going to have the same problems,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to be bringing my same expertise to bear, and we're going to be ordering the same sorts of tests or investigations, and I'll be making my referrals. So in terms of just day-to-day seeing patients, it's not that different. What's really different is the context in which it's happening. It might be helpful just to give a little example of...
It'd be great, a story or anything.
Yeah. I mean, I'm right now sitting in my office and saw patients all morning. And so what happened, you know, they come in the door, they say hi, they have their card, their number, whatever. No one has to check for whether or not it's still valid or whether it changed from one plan to another or if they have co-pays that they need or anything. They just come in. It's their visit. Go down the hall. I see them. I do whatever is necessary. Don't have to fill out any extra form. I go to my EMR, my electronic medical record. I put down what I did and get sent off by the one part-time bookkeeper who services a 6-physician practice. And 2 weeks later, I get money.
Huh. That sounds really heavenly.
You know, it's
amazing. I mean, it's actually amazing what you don't do, you know, and all of that, you know?
Right.
there's just you just cut right through it.
So
I'm spending
my time
taking care of patients and being concerned about their medical. I'm practicing medicine, not paperwork.
Mm. So, you know, if you talk to people in this country, they sort of, in a knee-jerk fashion, say, oh, we couldn't have socialized medicine here. We have to have our system, which is incredibly in disarray. So here's my question. You, as a Canadian physician, are told what you're going to earn and how things are going to go by the government. They become the single payer. And if you're going to have a contest between the medical establishment in the government, that's how things would get ironed out. Whereas in this country, most physicians are working for a bunch of insurance companies, and if they were going to take them on, they'd have to take them on one at a time. So which is the one that you think enables you and your patients to benefit the most?
Well, I have to say that it's really nice not to be spinning your wheels dealing with a multiplicity of people to fight against, for starters. And the thing that the government tells you what you're going to get is kind of an oversimplification. I think a lot of people don't realize that Medicare, which is, this is kind of ironic, but the name of the system in Canada is called Medicare.
We stole it.
So, you know, it's people who have Medicare in the U.S., for the most part, even though there's, of course, things that they might want to improve, but generally, it's been a pretty popular program, and I have to say it's incredibly popular here in Canada. People routinely give very high marks. They don't want to get rid of the system that they have, just as people don't want to get rid of Medicare in the States. In terms of the government telling you what to do, again, it's a little more complicated. There is a Canada Health Act, and there's a federal level at which there are certain things which need to be included in the health services in each province. The province is like a state.
Mm-hmm.
But each province actually has its own ability to modify what that plan looks like. They just can't go below the basic requirements. So they can add other things or tweak them. And in addition, each province negotiates with the medical association for how they're going to pay the physicians. So the physicians have quite a say in it. There's a back and forth and a negotiation that goes on. And it's not the same from province to province. But there's an agreement on a fee structure. And people are familiar with fee structures from, you know, all of the different
all the insurance companies, right?
Exactly. So you have one fee structure, right?
And everybody goes home at the end of the day, and that's what you're going to get, and you don't have to go negotiate it with five different vendors.
Exactly. If you're going to get X amount of money, that's what you get. And the other thing is you get it.
And
you almost always get it. I mean, unless you did something egregious. The way it used to be in the States, I remember, you would submit your bill, and maybe you'd get it, and maybe you wouldn't. And maybe they would have changed the rules on you, and maybe you had to spend 6 months trying to get paid. But here, essentially, you have an agreement where you're going to get paid, and they pay you, and they don't micromanage.
It sounds like it's cutting out a lot. You mentioned the paperwork before, and you mentioned that you had this one part-time person who was helping to submit this for six different doctors.
Right.
Whereas in the United States, we pay all this money to try to keep our practice open, to have all these people who are helping with paperwork and fighting for the bills and the insurance company and all of this. And it sounds to me like it's simplified a lot in your office. Is that borne out to be true for you?
Oh, unbelievably so. And it's much simpler also for the patients, because if I want to send someone to the hospital or a specialist, I don't have to worry about what plan they're in or, you know, whether we have an agreement with it or whether it's switched from one day to the next. You know, you probably have this, those handheld, like Hippocrates-type programs,
mm-hmm.
the application.
Yep.
You know, you have the 50 different formularies
uh-huh.
that you can use and
uh-huh.
have a special app. There's no need for an app here because everyone's basically pretty much got the same plan.
So you can prescribe a medication and it will be paid, or do you only have certain medications that are on the plan you can choose from?
Well, actually, that's an interesting point, because the Canada Health Act provides for medically necessary services, which includes doctor visits, hospital visits, and the supporting tests and examinations. Pharmaceuticals were actually not part of that original plan.
Hmm.
Some of the provinces have, all the provinces have made different different efforts to try to include that. But that is one of the reasons, one of the things that needs to be reined in terms of cost to Canada is how we deal with pharmaceuticals, because there isn't a federal plan on the payment. However, we don't have a lot of different plans to tell you what you can or can't prescribe. There's a share of cost, for example, for most places. A few provinces do have pharmaceutical coverage, but it's not quite as straightforward as the medical services.
We need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking to our guest, family physician Dr. Katya Hendry, about demystifying the Canadian healthcare system. We'll be right back with Your Health.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. We've been talking with Dr. Katya Hendry about demystifying the Canadian healthcare system. Dr. Hendry is a U.S.-trained family physician who spent 25 years working in the United States and has spent the last seven working in Canada. And in Canada. Sorry. That faraway land called Canada. But we were talking a little bit about socialized medicine, or this fear that having a single-payer system is socializing medicine. And one of the things I hear a lot from people in my family and people who are concerned about any talk of that in our country is this perception people are waiting in lines and that care is getting rationed out, and that if you want a transplant, you can't get one because of the long lines. Tell us how that bears out, or is that true?
Well, that's certainly not my experience at all. I think one of the things that people have their own ideas of what they think it looks like, and I was just, it was very ironic. I moved to Canada, and immediately I am working in a private doctor's office. I have much more say over how I take care of my patients and what I do than I ever did working in the States. I was, in fact, an employee, and I had people micromanaging me almost on a daily basis, from all the different insurance companies to the different government agencies to everything else. I have to say there is much less intrusion by the government or any kind of insurance agencies here in Canada than there is in the United States. That's number one.
Wow.
The other thing is, a lot of people think we're all just employees of the government, and that is absolutely not true. Most of the doctors are in private practice. We have a fee scale that we have agreed to through our negotiations with our medical associations. So, you know, that is a single-payer source, so it is publicly administered, but it's not government officials that are running it. It's the doctors that are running the medical system in terms of deciding what we want our patients to have and so on. So the question of lines and so on really just has to do with supply and demand. So if you're in an area like a big country, so you have a lot of rural areas, and you're not going to have immediate access to subspecialists if you're up in the Northwest Territories. So obviously there's some
That's true for rural America as well, right?
Well, exactly. And the other thing is that there are some issues with over-treatment when you have too many specialists, because if they're there, they're going to want to work, right?
Hmm.
So there is a better distribution, I would say, throughout the country. The places where people run into trouble are either where you just have a shortage of doctors, and that's, again, mostly in the rural areas, not unlike many parts of the world, or in places where you have not as many specialists as you need, and in elective areas.
So what about the concern that, you know, I want my knee replacement? It's not, you know, emergent,
right?
But I'm going to have to wait forever to get one.
Well, you don't wait forever. I mean, you might get it next year instead of this year, but you don't wait forever. But people are still concerned. You know, everyone is very involved in their medical care because we're all part of the system, so people are quite vocal about it, so you certainly hear about it. But in fact, if people need a knee replacement, they will get it, and they will not go bankrupt from it, and they will have it done at a reasonable time. But sometimes, you know, but there have been some issues, so then what have they done to deal with that? They have developed a wait list system throughout the country, and each province has a different way of dealing with it. They have worked on different ways to expedite some of these elective procedures that people want to go faster. And so in BC, for example, they have a website where you can go and see who has shorter wait times and then ask to be referred to a physician who has a shorter wait time as well. So people are working on it, but it's really the elective stuff, not the emergent thing. So just if I could, if you bear with me for a second, you know, for orthopedics, I often had a hard time getting services for my patients when I was in the States. And I don't know if that's your experience, but it turns out that it's not always that easy to get exactly what you want when you want it in the States either, and especially in the safety net. But here, if I have someone who really needs something, they get it. There's an orthopedist 24/7 at my hospital. If someone has a fracture or acute injury, they go there and they're seen that same day. And again, no one goes broke for that because they don't have to pay extra for it. And I have never, ever been in the situation here that I was in the States where I had to have a patient make a decision about a life-threatening situation versus financial disaster.
Mm-hmm. And that's a common scenario in our country.
You have a million examples of that, but I had a patient I thought was having a bleed into his brain, a subarachnoid hemorrhage, and was trying to convince him to go to the emergency room, and he was terrified because he had no insurance, and it would be expensive.
That was the United States story.
That's the United States. I never have that problem here. It wouldn't even be thinkable.
I remember seeing a movie where the question was asked of a couple of Canadian citizens who wanted to come to the United States for a wedding in their family, that they bought some kind of insurance for a couple of weeks so that if anything happened here, they would get taken care of. They were that afraid to come here because of the possibility of that happening.
Well, people are terrified of that, and absolutely you need insurance when you go. We do have snow up here. You probably heard of that. So quite a few people are snowbirds, and they go south. Many go to the States, and they always have insurance. And I get people coming back who've had things happen in the States and still end up with thousands and thousands of dollars of debt even after their insurance pays. If it had happened here in Canada, they wouldn't have had any of that.
That's absolutely amazing to me. So do family doctors play the gatekeeper role in Canada?
Well, actually we do, in part because it's much more family practice friendly. Everyone's just used to that's how you get care as you see your family doctor, which as a family doctor, I love. It's not overly specialized in that way. If someone wants to see a specialist, then I refer them. So, yes, I'm a gatekeeper. Now, you could go and see a specialist on your own if they would see you, but most of the specialists won't do that because they don't get a special consultation fee if it doesn't come from the family doctor. So there's nothing prohibiting them from doing it, but they prefer the family doctor to send them. The other thing which is kind of interesting is that it's not only is it family doctor friendly, but the pediatricians and the internists in Canada are specialists, and meaning that people don't go there for their primary care. They're referred by the family doctors for specific issues.
Interesting. And what about a medical home? So people are attached to you as their doctor and your practice as a place that they receive primary care?
Oh, completely.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, you go to your doctor. That's your doctor, right? And so that's your medical home. Now, there's a lot of interest in Canada on improving the medical home and making sure everyone has one, because we still do struggle with that, making sure everyone has their own family doctor, and that's a really big issue for people. It's been done differently in different areas. So in Ontario, for example, they've used a lot of multidisciplinary clinic settings, and in that setting, usually there's some combination of salary and fee for service, and then in other areas, not so much. So it's experimented with differently across Canada, but absolutely, that's the idea, is for everyone to have their own family doctor, have a place that they go, have their medical home.
Do you have what's called pay for performance down here, up there? That is where if you do certain things, you'll make more money because your payers are telling you it's the right thing to do.
Or a way that they monitor the quality of care?
Not exactly the way that they have it in the U.S. There's a lot of discussion about whether there might be some role for some of that. In my office, the closest thing I could say that we get to that is an incentive program for family doctors to encourage us to take care of people with chronic illnesses and doomed maternity care and see people in nursing homes and so on. So there are special fee codes that we can submit for doing full-service family practice, essentially, to make it more financially attractive than, say, just doing walk-in clinics or something like that. That's not exactly pay for performance, but it is pay for providing certain types of services, and it's certainly not punitive in any way.
Mm-hmm.
There's also some experimenting for increasing the elective surgeries, in which hospitals get more money the more surgeries that they do, which is a little bit of a twist on what they're currently doing.
Well, we are going to have to wrap up our conversation, but gosh, Dr. Hendry, thank you for taking the time to talk with us, and you really did demystify some of our questions and what I hear a lot of concerns about the Canadian healthcare system. Doesn't sound perfect, but gosh, that the idea that you can see patients and take care of them without 12 different arguments over how to get paid sounds pretty dreamy.
Can I just say one parting shot, and that is that one of the things I'm most impressed with is that you don't lose your insurance. In other words, no worries about pre-existing conditions. If you lose your job, you don't lose your insurance.
Mm.
If you have dependents or married or not or whatever, you still have the insurance. So, you know, you don't lose it. You always have that sense that you're taken care of and that you belong, and people aren't going to leave you in the dust or make you bankrupt. People are worried about their health and getting better. They're not worried about the bill they're going to get at the end of the day.
Well, thank you for taking that extra second with us. It's hard to end the conversation because there's so many questions we have about how it works over there. But you are good neighbors, and appreciate you taking a moment with us to demystify the Canadian healthcare system.
Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to take some time to talk about your health questions and concerns. We got some good ones today.
If you have a question you'd like for us to answer or address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to answer a few questions from our listeners now.
And we've got some good ones, Bob. We're going to talk about E. coli and some concerns about that, about a diet if you have celiac disease, about concussions, and about food allergies and nausea. So let's take our first one.
I had a urinary tract infection, and my doctor said that there was E. coli in my urine. And I've been reading in the paper about all these very sick children in the hospital with E. coli infections. Would that apply to me?
Well, there's no doubt that we've had an epidemic, a small one, of bad E. coli infections that seem to have occurred in conjunction with the fair again this year. But the notion is this: E. coli is in all of our gastrointestinal tracts. It is a common,
that's in your gut,
normal flora. And this isn't all E. coli. This is one unusual strain of E. coli, numbered 1057, that causes these really bad things to happen.
And the E. coli that causes urine infections, for one, it's one of the very most common causes, bacterial causes of getting a urine infection. And thankfully, we've got antibiotics that will treat it. And usually people get urine symptoms. If that persists, you could get a kidney infection, a worse infection, or even through your body. But if you go to the doctor and get your antibiotic for your urinary infection, then typically it doesn't make you very sick and is not nearly as scary as what you're seeing on the news about this other E. coli.
Right.
Let's take our next one.
I was diagnosed with celiac disease 3 years ago, and I have had trouble cutting carbohydrates down in my diet. It seems like I'm a vegetarian, and I have a hard time eating gluten-free without eating a high-carb diet. Can you help me with that?
this is a hard, hard question. And I feel for you to have to think about not eating anything with gluten in it. And also, as a vegetarian, not eating meat. And every time I would think about, oh, you can eat this, and I think, oh, that's either meat or something with gluten in it. So that's a tough one.
So people that won't eat or can't eat meat are going to have to eat something. And it turns out that carbohydrates are one of the big groups of foods, and they almost of necessity must eat something in that group. However, there are many foods that are higher in carbs and higher in so-called high glycemic carbohydrates that you can avoid if you want to. And there's plenty of things that you can eat with a gluten-free diet that are carbohydrates, too. You can eat, for instance, rice and corn.
And certain potatoes.
And potatoes and stuff.
And don't forget that fruits and vegetables would fall into a category of things that are gluten-free and also vegetarian. So your basic diet of fruits and vegetables can be a major part of your diet without getting all of those high carb things into your diet.
And you can eat a very healthy diet with lots of fruits and vegetables and avoid the rice and the corn sort of carbs.
Right. And you just have to make sure they're not breaded and batter coated and marinated in a way that would get gluten into those vegetables. But provided there are fresh fruits and vegetables, you're good. I would recommend, considering how complex this is, being a vegetarian and trying to do gluten-free, that you talk with a nutritionist, that you talk with your doctor, but that you also have that nutrition appointment to tailor some diets, a diet that works for you in particular. Let's do our next question.
Hi. My 40-year-old daughter fell off her horse, and even though she had a helmet on, she had a concussion, and it's been over 6 weeks, and she's still having frequent headaches and attention problems, difficulty working, fatigue, and she gets easily overwhelmed in noisy environments. How long can that last?
Ouch. I think concussions are really hard for us as physicians to guide people, because it's not as cut and dry as we see this thing on the x-ray and this is exactly what's going to happen. And it's so different for each person on how long they have symptoms. And the symptoms are vague: headaches and pain and confusion sometimes. And what do you think, Bob?
Well, it's a very common phenomenon. And, you know, because you have a concussion doesn't mean you have to have a bruise or a laceration or anything else. It just means your brain got shaken around good. Can happen in a whiplash injury or falling off a bicycle or, in this case, a horse. So it's pretty common. It's what physicians are trained to look for on the sidelines of the football games on mm-hmm. Friday night. So somebody gets their head hit hard and they come back to the sidelines and they may not remember it. They didn't have to get knocked unconscious, but they're just not thinking. They may not clearly, and they may not be able to do simple things like adding and subtracting.
And in this case, you know, headaches, attention problems, fatigue, difficulty working, noisy environments causing a problem. Those are things, I mean, it sounds like it's a real good chance that that's coming from that concussion. The good news is most people get better in a couple weeks and even more than that in a few months. But there is a small subset of people who will still have symptoms at a year out from that concussion.
So what I think people can do is try to seek somebody who can advise them on this. There are support groups for this. And get educated about the things that they can expect, the fact that it can go on for an undetermined period of time, and that likely it's going to clear up. There are also some treatments for the pain or the depression or the anxiety that comes forth just as if you were treating a person without concussion.
The other thing that may not matter as much in your situation or your daughter's situation, falling off the horse, but we think about a whole lot with athletes, is this thing called second impact syndrome, where we don't want you to have a concussion shortly after you just had one, because that can be life-threatening. So for people, especially if you're still having symptoms, we really want you to be careful not to fall off a horse again, if you can help it, or to go out and play contact sports or something where you you'd be at a higher risk of banging up your brain again.
And there are real concerns about, for instance, NFL football players who subject themselves to these kind of injuries for years and then wind up with various kinds of problems, including dementia later in life because of that.
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit on a show about head trauma a few weeks back. So check out our blog to get that show with Cindy Parlow about soccer players in particular and protecting their brains. Okay, let's do our last house call question about food allergies.
I have a question about food allergies. Lately, I've been feeling nauseous right after I eat a meal, and I'm definitely not pregnant. Could I have a food allergy?
So this is a tough one, really, to put your finger on why she's being why she's nauseated after she eats something. I mean, clearly pregnancy is something that can cause people to be nauseated even without eating, but that's not the issue here, I gather.
So, well, I've heard from my patients before who say, oh, I'm not pregnant. I don't feel full, but I know I'm not pregnant. I'm like, how do you know you're not pregnant? So I would definitely want to be sure you've tested and that you definitely know you're not pregnant.
But, you know, given that she isn't, could this be an allergy? Boy, allergy is not the thing that jumps in my head right away.
No, nausea after a meal can be lots of things, right?
Yeah, and classic allergy, I don't think it is. Some people might have an unusual side effect from some food, or, I mean, we know it's classic with some medications that people take. And if she started taking a new medication, particularly if she takes it at mealtime, I'd have a really good look at that. But that's not an allergy. That's a side effect.
Yeah. Nausea after eating. And we talked about pregnancy, but you'd also want to think about, you know, reflux disease or heartburn type symptoms, gastritis or inflammation in your belly. Could be an ulcer or even gallbladder disease can sometimes give you those sorts of symptoms. Even just having a virus. That shouldn't go on and on and on, but sometimes the only symptom of you having a GI bug is feeling some nausea in your belly, even after you eat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, I don't know about you, Bob, but it sounds like both of us, wouldn't think of food allergy at the top of the list of things that can cause nausea after eating. Possible, but not common.
And more likely a side effect of something than a true allergy.
Well, we've had a chance to talk about E. coli and about having a complicated diet if you're a vegetarian and you have celiac disease, about concussions, and a little bit about nausea after eating and food allergies. Thank you for your questions. And thanks for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we have done a good job addressing some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. We want you to write us at yourhealth@unc.edu, visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, and you can also follow us on iTunes. We want to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, my fantastic guest host today, Dr. Bob Gwyther, and our guest, Dr. Kadi Hendry. We hope you'll come back next time on Your Health.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.